one book.
What, two? I've got two.
I've got one here.
I'm using this one.
You ready? This one's from Mother's Day, and it's a sing-along.
Well, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Glad you could make it today. I'm Dan Proud, a member of Prairie, and I'm the default minister today. I always wanted to be a minister. Prairie aspires to be an open-hearted and open-minded community or congregation, and we welcome people of any ethnic and religious background. No matter your skin color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. And no matter what your age or abilities or inabilities. And later on in the service, we'll invite visitors and guests and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we can greet you. So on Sunday mornings, we offer a variety of services. We have a part-time minister, Sandy Ingham, who sometimes speaks, and sometimes it's Prairie members, as today, or other outside guest speakers. So we'll start off with opening words by Robin Proud.
The opening words are brief. They're said by Angelica Schuyler in Hamilton. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And when I meet Thomas Jefferson, I'm going to compel him to put women in the sequel.
We'll start off with opening hymn number 105.
Nope.
What?
Announcements.
Oh, I skipped over the announcements. Thank you. Okay, I point out the announcements in your bulletins here. And in addition to that, there is one free place for the Prairie Auction Round Singing at the Tuksinski's on Saturday, May 19th. So there's still an opening. See Eileen. Is Eileen here? Okay. Well, anyway, Eileen Nettleton would be happy to hear from you. The book club meets today after the service here in this room. Everyone is welcome, even if you haven't read the book. The book is Manhattan Beach. The Capital Campaign is doing very well. Thank you to your generous gifts and our generous match. And we're still accepting pledges. So it's not too late. See Barb Chatterton, Heidi Hughes, Paula Pichars, Nancy Wonderland, and Patty Stockdale. Any one of those. be glad to talk to you. And our offering today will be supporting Project Respect, which is described in your announcements.
Hey, Dan, I didn't get a chance to write mine down.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. To come up with. Sure. So, not sure if you guys have heard, but I'm in Proud Theater this year, and the Proud Theater Madison, which is the group I'm with, is having our performance Memorial Day weekend, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Edgewood. So if anyone wants to come, that'd be great.
Great. Thank you, Jesse. Okay, now let's please turn to opening hymn number 105. Stand if you are able.
Lighting is number 461. And I'll read the plain text and you can read the italics. We must be saved. Nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime.
Therefore, we are saved.
Nothing true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history.
Therefore, we are saved by faith.
Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone.
Therefore, we are saved by love.
No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as from our own.
Therefore, we are saved by the final form of love.
I'm Reinhold Niebuhr. Thank you. Okay, so we do have a story for all ages. I know our youngest people went to do visits at the nursing home. So I think I'll just mention here what I have. This book called She Persisted. So sometime in the last year, Elizabeth Warren was speaking and was cut off by Mitch McConnell. What he said afterwards was, "She was warned, nevertheless, she persisted." And that became a meme. Chelsea Clinton picked up on this and worked with an illustrator to come up with this book, She Persisted, 13 American Women Who Changed the World. And I'll just mention briefly what's in here.
Read it to us.
Well, I can, yes, but I'm not going to read the whole thing. But so if anybody wants to come up, you're welcome to. It says, sometimes being a girl isn't easy. At some point, someone probably will tell you no, will tell you to be quiet, and may even tell you your dreams are impossible. Don't listen to them. These 13 American women certainly did not take no for an answer. They persisted. And there's a lady in a pantsuit right here that might look familiar. So we'll just mention who some of these are. Harriet Tubman, who helped many people escape from slavery. Helen Keller. Certainly no one thought she would achieve what she did. Someone I didn't know, Clara Lemlich. Her family fled poverty in the Ukraine, went to New York City, and she worked for women's rights in garment factories for better pay and hours and working conditions. Did not know that. Nellie Bly, who became a reporter partly because a male writer said working women were a monstrosity. Virginia Apgar, known for the Apgar score. She wanted to be a doctor at a time, and a surgeon at a time when that was not the given thing, but she persisted. Maria Tallchief, who was told she couldn't be a ballerina because she was Native American and that wouldn't look right, she persisted. Claudette Colvin, I didn't know this name, before Rosa Parks. She resisted giving up her seat to a white person on a bus.
Yes, she was a teenager.
Yes. Ruby Bridges, who as a child was a young black girl who was integrating a school in the South, where people were yelling, threatening. Margaret Chase Smith, the first woman to be a U.S. representative and U.S. senator, both. Sally Ride, the first astronaut, which at one time people said, no way, a woman could be an astronaut. Florence Griffith Joyner, who had to overcome poverty and other issues to become an Olympic champion. Oprah Winfrey, whose grandmother thought she would, like her, become a maid for her career. And Sonia Sotomayor, who was inspired by watching judges on TV and wanted to become one. Well, she had to learn to speak English well because she was originally Spanish-speaking, and of course she persisted and became a Supreme Court justice. So if anyone ever tells you no, if anyone ever says your voice isn't important or your dreams are too big, please remember these women, they persisted, and so should you. Thank you. And there is a sequel that came out this year called She Persisted Around the World, which features people from New Zealand and mentions Malala Yousafzai, who was our Nobel Prize winner, and so on. So that's delightful, too.
So we don't get to sing these people out.
Oh, there's no singing out, I guess. Okay. Yeah, so the children have gone to visit a assisted living facility or some other place where they've started to film a relationship with the people living there. So that is great.
I'm up.
All right. Joys and concerns.
Okay. All right, it's time for the joys, our joys and concerns. If any of you would like to share them, Mary has the mic.
Last weekend, Dean and I were in Gloucester, Massachusetts with our extended family doing a Unitarian Universalist dedication ceremony with a rose for little Gabby. And it's the oldest Unitarian Universalist church in America. And their congregation is actually smaller than ours, even though their church is quite a bit bigger. But it was a real delight to have the whole family together and to introduce Gabby to many of the people that she hadn't met before.
That church is in my speech.
Well, I've got one joy and a bunch of concerns. The joy is that our dog seemed to come through his surgery okay. It was on Friday, so he's got a couple more weeks before he can run around like he usually does. But he seemed to do well so far. So the concerns are, I guess, one, that the stress of dealing with that kind of brought out the worst in my marriage, and that we've been sort of at each other's throats for the last few days. And then in the last week, we both had points where we were about ready to walk away from our jobs. And I still have another surgery coming up, and my wife has some health issues. And I've been stressed out enough that I've been feeling too crappy physically to really have good riding. So anyhow, lots of concerns at the moment.
Dan, I wonder if I could squeeze a pet peeve in
announcement?
Officialized. I wonder if we could have the moment of silence in honor of David Goodall, the 105-year-old Australian scientist who decided it was time to die and had to fly to Switzerland to do so.
Okay, thanks. We'll do that after we're done with the joys and concerns.
I have a joy. I want to thank Randy and Kathy for loaning us once again the cart to wheel around the house on because one of our legs didn't work. And I now have two pretty much operational legs, and that will only improve as time goes by.
I would like to add a postscript to that on a somewhat different note that I've had to drive Pam around for the last several weeks because of her leg, and she had permission to get permission to try to drive, and now I don't have to be told all the time how to drive.
I have a joy that later today Martin and I will be driving to Milwaukee to pick up our daughter, who is going to only be here for like 2 days, but we'll take what we can get. has been at a weekend, what would you call it, dance club reunion at her college. I was taking dance classes and dancing all day yesterday, called us at 9 just to make sure that everything was square with the airport, and you could tell she had just opened up her eyes. So anyway, it'll be nice to see her for a couple days.
I have two things. One is I would suggest anybody who hasn't taken time to look at the paintings that are just breathtaking, that are up here because they're going down today. And we really thank the folks that have the incarcerated people art show that's going around to churches all over Madison, that we were able to have a share in it. And the second thing is every now and then it happens, but my daughter, Malian, was born today, on the 13th. And every now and I met her in China with her first birthday, and it was Mother's Day. And it doesn't happen very often, but today is Mother's Day and Marianne's birthday.
Yeah, as you know, my daughter's been the chair of the Democratic Party in Alaska, and then they had the big election for the next 4 years. She wasn't sure, you know, if she would get picked because she said, you know, I'm not everybody's favorite person. But they had the election, and in the end, nobody ran against her, and so she's got this for another 4 years.
Both joy and concern. I'm heading out to Laramie for the summer. So leaving the best time of year here in Madison and the lakes and everything. But I'll be there with a grandbaby and daughter, Erin, and back Labor Day. So see you in September.
For all those joys and concerns that were not expressed, would you like this last candle? Despite what Mom said we couldn't do. And now we'll have a moment of silent meditation. Keep George in your thoughts. Well, our speaker today is no stranger to most of you. My wife, Robin. What can I say about her that you don't know already? She has honed her public speaking skills, being involved with Toastmasters for several decades now. So if you have any thought of becoming a public speaker or a better, more confident speaker, talk to Robin. We have two children, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Louis, and we both met at Carleton College many years ago. That's our initial connection in the folk dance world. Robin has a special interest in historical figures, especially women, many of whom we've never heard of. So we're indebted to her for educating us on that. So please welcome Robin Proud.
I started talking about UU women quite a while ago, and I was mainly focusing on the 19th century. That was because one woman would tend to lead to another. They interacted or influenced each other. But I moved back in time. Now, that started partly because I read an excellent biography of Louisa Adams, John Quincy's wife, and I talked about that last year, how the political situation was not that different in those days from now. And I was influenced by my love of the Hamilton show. I started to read some more about that era. And also Sandy has presented on some of these early figures, so we're piggybacking on each other. Now, sometimes when I prepare to talk on a historical subject, I wonder whether it's an appropriate topic at a moment when there's so much to discuss in current events. But history and current events are not separate. The discussion about statues of Confederate soldiers is a discussion about history and whose view of history will dominate. The Founding Fathers' wishes are often invoked, even for opposing viewpoints. When I was in school in the 1960s, history tended to show that everything about America was great, westward expansion, colonialism, it was all an arc toward the greatness of America. And history class was largely about memorizing dates and facts about presidents and wars, but history is full of people with virtues and flaws and messy situations. Some of you have heard me say that I consider myself a humanist and therefore a person of great faith. I say this because the history of humankind is often destructive. Yet somehow I still believe that humans can improve themselves and their world. I think that takes more faith than believing a supernatural force will arrive from somewhere to set things right. And I find it encouraging to learn about people in the past who faced challenges, not unlike ours today, and dealt with them. So today I'm going to speak about some of our founding mothers. We always hear about founding fathers. These were women who lived and wrote in the colonial and revolutionary periods in our country. And they were free thinkers in religious or political areas. Well, being in a new community in a new continent gave women some advantages. Early on, they were a prized minority, as there were many more men than women who had made the trek across the ocean. Although life was dangerous for everyone, women had the additional hazard of almost constant pregnancy and childbirth. Because they were a scarce commodity, women in the early colonial period could be choosy about who they married. They might demand a monetary settlement or a house before they would marry. Another advantage women had over their more civilized sisters in the old country was they had opportunities to fill non-traditional roles. Men were often away, hunting, sailing, exploring, fighting wars. There weren't extra men to take over the work at home, so women ran businesses and farms. Ben Franklin's wife, Deborah, helped run a group of print shops, a real estate portfolio, and even the postal service. Although he seemed to take all this for granted during her lifetime, after her death, he wrote, "I always discovered that she knew what I did not know, and if something escaped me, I could be certain that this was precisely what she had grasped." Abigail Adams took charge of the family farm and all financial matters for years at a time while her husband John was acting as a diplomat in Europe. Sometimes every available person was needed to deal with the necessities of making a life in uncharted areas. So women might have helped with outdoor work, for instance, that they wouldn't have done in Europe. And as a frontier society, the colonies had fewer established bodies to regulate private behavior. The authority they did have was the church. It has been said that the Puritans came to the New World for religious freedom, for themselves, and everyone else who believed exactly as they did. Sandy spoke not long ago about Anne Hutchinson, and she's the first one here. This obviously is some kind of reconstruction. I don't think anyone actually did a portrait of her. She had the radical idea that anyone could connect with God. She had the nerve to actually think about the Bible and what it said. So she thought that anyone could experience salvation. For this heresy, she was banished. She was called a woman not fit for our society. She protested, "I desire to know wherefore I am banished. That is, why is this happening?" Governor John Winthrop replied, "Say no more. The court knows wherefore and is satisfied." That is, we know why, that's all. You could say she got off easily, as she wasn't accused of witchcraft, an all too common way to get rid of obstreperous women. She did move to Rhode Island, later to New York, and actually, tragically, she and her children were killed by Indians at a later time. And I was mentioning this to my brother last night. He said that there was a television show in maybe the late 50s, early 60s, called Profiles in Courage, based on John F. Kennedy's book, but it expanded to other people. And he remembered that Anne Hutchinson was featured, which I'm very impressed that at that somewhat conservative time that they featured a woman who was outspoken in religious matters. In a similar vein, the poet Anne Bradstreet, so she was considered sometimes the first American poet, she questions how she could be sure that hers was the one true religion. She said, "How could I know whether there was a God? I never saw any miracles to confirm me. And those which I read of, how did I know but they were feigned?" Right? Maybe it was fake news, right? How could she know that just because she heard of a miracle? And then there was very much, of course, anti-Catholic sentiment. But she said, "May not the Popish religion be right? They have the same God, the same word. They interpret it one way, we another." As the revolution approached, women were active in the political sphere, organizing boycotts of British goods, refusing to drink tea or wear clothes from England. Women put their creativity to work, making tea from currant, raspberry, or sage leaves, and crafting garments from homespun material. A British officer remarked to Cornwallis, "We may destroy all the men in America, and we still shall have all we can do to defeat the women." Mercy Otis Warren is over here.
Name again?
Oh, her name is Mercy Otis Warren. Her brother was James Otis, who was active against the Stamp Act. And she herself was a historian, poet, and essayist. She was known for her satirical attacks on the British and their loyalist allies. She eventually wrote a 3-volume eyewitness history of the Revolution. Some credit her with helping organize the committees of correspondence, which were the first gatherings of representatives from the various colonies before any kind of constitutional convention. Although we wouldn't exactly call her a feminist, Mercy Warren, like Abigail Adams and the others I'm going to talk about, recognized the defects in women's education. She wrote, "I believe it will be found that the deficiency lies not so much in the inferior contexture of the female intellect as in a different education bestowed on the sexes. That is, women do not have a lesser intellect, but they do not get the same education. When these temporary distinctions subside, we may be equally qualified to taste the full draft of knowledge and happiness prepared for the upright of every nation and sex." Women not only took on many roles while their menfolk were off fighting the revolution, but many of them went along. This happened in Europe at the time as well. There were many camp followers, and these were generally not prostitutes, as you might think. They were wives, laundresses, and cooks. The army paid them and provided some rations. Martha Washington was with her husband for most of the war. She had some incentives for this. The loyalist governor of Virginia apparently tried to capture her as a hostage at one time, and the press claimed that she was a secret loyalist herself, who was deliberately living apart from her husband. So she took a journey north to join George, who was in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time, and it was a publicity event. Along the way, she met with patriot groups. Then she stayed with George in Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey, and she was even there in Valley Forge. She made trips back to Mount Vernon to collect supplies. There really was no supply organization. There was no real government. Martha was not a young woman. She was 43 when the revolution started. Of course, the other stalwart wife of the time was Abigail Adams, and I've decided she deserves a program of her own, so I look forward to that. After the war, the leaders of the new country were very conscious that they were conducting an unprecedented experiment. With no king, the people would govern. How would they learn to become citizens and take on their responsibilities? The only models were classical. They looked to the ancient Greek city-states. And the new society took very seriously the values of citizenship. Included in that was the role of women as the mothers who would educate future citizens. So John Adams famously treated Abigail's request to remember the ladies as a joke, but he also wrote, "It is by the female world that the greatest and best characters among men are formed." Those with some money could now send their girls to female or coeducational academies. It's at this point that Judith Sargent Murray came onto the public scene. With all my research, Judith was new to me this year. Yet I've known about her husband for some time, so that's John Murray. Now, it may be that she's becoming a bit more known because recently she's been being rediscovered. She kept letter books, which means she kept a copy of every letter she wrote. This is very valuable. Scholar Bonnie Heard Smith is still in the process of transcribing and annotating these letters. Now, in my over 25 years of teaching Unitarian Universalist Sunday School, I've learned the story of John Murray's arrival in the New World, so I'm going to give you the children's version. I don't know whether Jesse might remember that. You're the only one that's probably been here long enough to have heard this. This is right off of one of the UU sites or one of the UU curricula. "You never know what the wind will blow in or which way the wind blows. The wind can change directions or maybe change your life. It happened to John Murray. As a young man in England, John Murray had excellent fortune blow his way. He had a fine education, a steady job, a loving wife, and a young son. Life was good. But suddenly everything changed. John Murray's wife and their son became sick and died. John lost his job, lost all his money, and was put in jail because he could not pay his bills. John was a very religious man, a universalist, who had even preached about a loving God. Now he was not so sure what he believed. He felt his life was over. Friends urged him to go someplace where he could start again. He sailed for America on a ship named the Hand in Hand. The wind blew the ship toward their destination, New York, but then fog rolled in and the ship ran aground in New Jersey instead. John and a few others volunteered to leave the ship, go on land, and get directions and supplies. As he was walking ashore, John saw a farmhouse with a small chapel beside it. It belonged to a man named Thomas Potter. Thomas Potter greeted John, gave him food for the people on the ship, and invited John to come back and have dinner with him that night. When John came back, Thomas Potter showed him the chapel. He said that he believed in a loving God who wanted to accept all people into heaven. Well, John said he believed the same thing. Thomas Potter told John he had built the chapel and was waiting for God to send him a minister. "You, John, are that minister. I have waited for you a long time." John did not want to hear this. He was not a preacher anymore, and he was determined to never preach again. Yet Thomas Potter seemed confident that John was the universalist preacher he waited for, and he asked John to preach on Sunday. "I can't preach on Sunday," said John, "because as soon as the wind changes, my boat will set sail and I must be on it." "If the boat has not sailed by Sunday, will you preach?" asked Thomas Potter. "If I'm still here on Sunday, I will preach," said John Murray. No wind blew. No ship sailed. John Murray preached on Sunday morning, September 30th, 1770, in the chapel Thomas Potter had built many years before. The Universalist message of the power of love was good news to many who heard. It was good news for John. The winds of change blew yet again for John Murray. He now wanted to preach more than anything, and he did, for many years, and helped found Universalism in America. He's one of the ancestors of our faith home, and we as Unitarian Universalists owe a special thanks to Thomas Potter. It was his hospitality that brought John Murray back to the pulpit. We also owe a special thanks to the wind that blew him in and would not blow him out. This is our Unitarian myth. I'm a little disturbed by how mythologized this is and how miraculous this is depicted. Now, when I used to have Jesse and others in class, when we had some of these stories, I'd say, well, we do not have any video of what actually happened at the time. So this is the story. But John Murray is often featured in our Unitarian curricula, Universalist curricula as well. A side note is that it's through a woman that John Murray became a Universalist in the first place. He started out in England as a Calvinist preacher. He heard that a young woman in his area had joined the congregation of a heretic, George Relly. Relly reasoned that Christ had died for everyone, therefore everyone was saved, not just a select few. Murray called on this woman to disabuse her of her error, but she debated him with so convincingly that he ended up joining the new church himself. Now, Judith Sargent came from a family of some means. She read and wrote from an early age. In 1769, at the age of 18, she married not John Murray, but a man named John Stevens, the son of a prominent shipping family. The following year, her whole family learned about Universalism and invited Murray to Gloucester, Massachusetts. So I don't know, Orange, if you have any pictures from that church, but afterwards, maybe you would like to show those. So that's delightful that you happened to be there, because this was one of the first Universalist churches, obviously, in the country. It probably was the first after this tiny chapel that is probably no longer there. Judith and her husband had no children, but she raised two nieces, and as a result, she began to teach other children in the new church, and she actually published a catechism or children's lessons about Universalism. In 1784, Judith published her first essay, which included the following: I would, from the early dawn of reason, address my daughter as a rational being, and by all means guard daughters against a low estimation of themselves. Unfortunately, the shipping business operated by Judith's husband was wiped out by the war. To avoid debt, he escaped in 1786 to the West Indies, where he tried to set up a new business, but he died soon after his arrival. 2 years later, John Murray, still a widower because his wife had died back in England, wrote to Judith that he had long loved her. So he had been a friend of their family since they invited him to Gloucester. They married. They had a son who lived only a few hours. 2 years later, at age 40, Judith bore her only surviving child, Julia Maria Murray. Around this time, she also brought into the world an essay called On the Equality of the Sexes. Like other essayists of the time, she used a Latin pen name. She called herself Constantia, or Constance. And here are a few excerpts. She said, are we, that is women, are we deficient in reason? We can only reason from what we know. And if opportunity of acquiring knowledge hath been denied us, the inferiority of our sex cannot fairly be deduced from thence. That is the same thing. How can we be blamed if we were never given education? And talking about the supposed superiority of the male, it may be questioned, from what does this superiority proceed? May we not trace its source in the difference of education and continued advantages? Will it be said that the judgment of a male of 2 years old is more sage than that of a female of the same age? I believe the reverse is generally observed to be true. But from that period, what partiality? How is one exalted and the other depressed by the contrary modes of education which are adopted? The one is taught to aspire, and the other is early confined and limited. As their years increase, the sister must be wholly domesticated, while the brother is led by the hand through all the flowery paths of science. She experiences a mortifying consciousness of inferiority, which embitters every enjoyment. Now, was she permitted the same instructors as her brother for the employment of a rational mind? An ample field would be opened. I would ask, is it reasonable that an intelligent being should at present be so degraded as to be allowed no other ideas than those which are suggested by the mechanism of a pudding or the sewing of the seams of a garment? Yes, ye lordly, ye haughty sex, that is men, our souls are by nature equal to yours. The same breath of God animates, enlivens, and invigorates us. So Judith wrote this in 1779 during her first marriage, although she didn't publish it until later. This was well before Mary Wollstonecraft's famous Vindication of the Rights of Women in 1792 and Margaret Fuller's Woman in the 19th Century, which was still shocking in 1845. Judith's husband, John Murray, supported her writing and beliefs, and she joined him in spreading universalism in the new country. Hers was a voice of inspiration to the infant republic. With Judith Sargent Murray, I finally found a woman who could be a public figure with radical ideas and a supportive partner. So some of the women I've studied just remained single, the astronomer Mariah Mitchell and the sociologist Harriet Martineau. Both expressed how pleased they were with their single status. Margaret Fuller married very late in life to a younger man who was not at all her intellectual equal. Julia Ward Howe went from a controlling father to a controlling husband. He despised her desire to speak and write in public. You may remember that the day after her husband died, Julia Ward Howe wrote in her journal, "My new life begins today." And her husband was a wonderful person in a way that he had an academy that taught deaf and blind students. He taught Laura Perkins, who was a forerunner of Helen Keller. But he had ideas about what wives should do and not do. Lydia Maria Child, the abolitionist, found a husband who shared her activism. He also believed in abolition and women's rights, but he kept throwing money into far-fetched schemes so that they were always poor, and eventually she had to transfer her money from him to another man because even in the second half of the 19th century, a woman could not control her own finances. So that was not the best relationship either. Even in the time of great upheaval and reinvention that the American Revolution represented, Judith was way ahead of her time. And the fact that she found a husband who supported her seems to me a greater miracle than the wind, which supposedly kept John Murray on shore to preach the first Universalist sermon in America. So we have some time for comments and questions.
Happy to share pictures of the church if anyone is interested, and we did take some pictures of the signs about the founding of the congregation. But when you were talking before about George Washington's wife following him, I had not really thought about the role of the wives of the principal characters of the Revolution, but it did remind me that one of my ancestors, whose name of course I'm blanking on, was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and his wife was captured by the British and held hostage. I think she might have been held hostage in her own home, but the suffering of that time period led to her early demise. Yeah. So it was not a period where the spouses went unscathed if their husbands were politically active.
I was also struck by this issue of what happened to Martha Washington as brand new information. It's just another piece of... I am so frustrated by our selective history that we learn. I should know that fact. I'm just so sorry that I had to be almost 60 before I heard it.
Yeah, no, I didn't really know about that either. I believe that I should have brought that book. I found a couple books at Frugal Muse. I get so many good ideas from Muse bookshops, but it's called something like Founding Mothers and talked about these women, including the story about Martha Washington.
Yeah, the Potter homestead and church, I think, is set aside as by the Universalists as, and I'm not sure if it's a camp or if it's just a park or what it is, but I know I've read that it, do you remember, Rick? Do you know? But I do remember that it is still in existence. I don't know that the chapel is still there, because that'd be pretty old. But it may have been rebuilt and maintained. But yeah, it's kind of a sacred place, as it were, for Universalists.
Which way does the wind blow?
I think it probably varies.
I don't know if we have to look as far as those profiles in courage. I came to Madison in 1970, and we have the people who transformed Madison were Becky Young, Mitch Miller, Mary Lou Munz, Kate Clarenbach. We have a wonderful panel, you know. Maybe we can give some attention to them sometime.
Yeah, right, we don't have to go back far in history. It's just that the common knowledge or common expectation about what women could do or say was even more restricted in these times, and yet, as we saw in this, she persisted still into, certainly well into modern times.
I just want to thank you for the extensive research you did and the excellent presentation. It was really terrific.
That's really delightful. And like I said, I'll send something to Prairie Fire about a couple of these books that I used.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested in hearing, you know, individual women talking about what their experience was growing up, you know, who encouraged them, or, you know, whether it was their fathers, their mothers, other people in the community. And I just wanted to share that when I was much younger and was taking my car to the mechanics, you know, some mechanics would be willing to discuss, you know, the mechanics of the car, what was wrong with my car, as if I were a person, and others just treated me like I was a woman who could not understand anything about mechanics.
Yeah,
of course, I could understand mechanics, and I thought much later I could have become a mechanic if someone had ever taken the interest in showing me. And my uncle did that. You know, he showed me how to file the points and, you know, how to grease every machine, every round you went of the field when I was working on my uncle's farm. But, you know, those little things can make a huge difference. So does anyone have anything to share?
I had a contrasting experience. My father taught me how to change the tires on the car because, as he said, there might not always be a man there. But I have a question for you guys, because I heard something on the radio. You know how you turn on the radio and you have a short drive and you don't get the whole story? Mm-hmm. There was something about an auto mechanic shop that was being set up for women, where they were training women to be mechanics, and the idea was that then they would treat their women customers better. And if anybody remembers any of the details of that, I'd like to know more.
I think it was maybe for women who had been abused.
You know, I think you're right, yeah. Right.
And we have new fronts in this struggle, like whole tech community issues and online issues.
I have a car story to share with you. All the way through college, I was very good friends with the chemistry stockroom manager, and he had an interest in antique cars, which I shared, and so he would take me out and pop the hood on an old Cadillac, and he would point out things, and he taught me a lot about engines, so that I felt a lot more competent. And you know, when I was out here shopping for my first car and then having the experience of being treated terribly, the car that I ended up purchasing was because when I came in and said, this is what I'm looking for, the first thing the salesman showed me was the engine instead of the vanity mirror. But the other kind of interesting experience that I had related to cars is that when I was out in Wisconsin as a young graduate student, I had an old Oldsmobile. And in that day and age, when you replaced a headlight, you had to actually replace the whole thing and buy a special screwdriver to do it. And so I was out with a male friend, and I go into Sears, and I go and I buy what I need and a screwdriver, and then I go out to the parking lot and pop the hood on the car and just do it. And he's looking at me like I had three heads. And he's like, to do that? I'm like, it's just a couple of screws. but that he looked at it as being such a surprising thing that I would even think to handle that myself.
And the flip side is, I don't know if anyone's brave enough to admit this, but there are some men who have no interest or talent in mechanical things, and you're supposed to pretend that you do, right?
And women, too.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, that's right. We don't have to all do that.
Well, I have a car story.
Okay.
My mother was born in 1893, and her father bought the first family car when she was in her early teens.
Wow.
And he had two daughters, and he taught them everything about the car. And everything he knew, he was a very skillful, man with no formal education. He taught the girls, and he provided, taught them to drive the car, and provided them with monkey suits to wear when they were driving, because they might have to change a tire or do some other repairs. And my mother dutifully learned all of this stuff. And then she figured out on her own before she was 17 or 18, she did not wear the monkey suit. She wore her beautiful white frilly dress. And if she had any trouble, she just got out of the car and stood beside the road until so some nice young man came up and changed the tire for her. She played both sides of the street. And she fixed everything.
Well, the fact that I've got multiple degrees in fisheries and wildlife is a strong indication that I didn't follow any of the squeamish females in my family. And I was always in trouble because I always had worms, half-dead animals in my room that I shared with my sister. And I probably tormented her a little, but on to my father was a great hunter and fisherman, and his sons were 10 years older than me, so when I came along, that's what I spent all my time doing, was going fishing and hunting with my dad. And I'm sure that's why I ended up in fisheries and wildlife. I was a nurse for a while. I tried a really feminine career, but I did switch. And so I definitely think I also know how to repair a car and a few other things, because my dad used to go around repairing people's stoves and refrigerators and toasters, so I used to always go with him. So it is definitely the influence of who you spend your time with.
Well, on the theme of yet she persisted, one of the things that has given me strength throughout my life is I've always been a history buff. Thinking about women like this, or really women all over the world who raise children, who do the daily work that needs to be done, and that takes a lot of strength. So, it's almost the part of not being recognized for what you do that inspires me at times. So I wanted to say that to just lift up all women who work very hard every single day, and most don't get in history books. But it takes a lot of strength and courage. But another thing that I think historically is, I wonder about these women up here as well as many others who did get the education, even if not officially, in order to write such intellectual statements that Robin has shared with us. And my personal experience is that I got most of my interest in being a continuously educated person from conversations about religion. Had around the dinner table, after going to church. And I'm wondering if these women were also inspired by that, because I think some of the most educated people back in these days, or back historically, were people who got that education through study of religious sorts of topics and all the, underlying philosophies that arise through a religious debate, like freedom, the role of government, the role of God. I mean, these big kind of philosophical topics. So I think religion has a lot to do with lifting up these women, because I'm guessing that is one of the foundational elements of their ability to debate and to be so articulate. So I find that a common thread as well with me and my family.
Mm-hmm.
I don't wish to belittle the influence of religion, but I have found the same message that we're hearing today in the funnies. Luann is a comic strip that I like a great deal, and she and her hunk of a boyfriend were driving along when they had a flat tire. And he didn't know what to do, so she got out and changed the tire.
Anybody else? We still could have 5 or 10 minutes.
Oh, gosh. Can't I talk short?
Well, I was thinking how women's independence and rights tend to fluctuate up and down over time. I read that during the late 1800s, there were more women who were ministers, became ministers, than there were in the early 20th century, which surprised me a lot to read that. And then, of course, when World War II came along, you got this huge influx of women into the workplace just because the men were off fighting the war. And then when the war was done, you had this high women's participation, and then they were expected to go back home, and many did. And then gradually, it's the upswing now is where women are more or less expected to work. So it's been a tide up and down, up and down. When I was a child, my mother was an art major in college and was a textile design person. When she started work, was the Monday after Pearl Harbor, and they said they had hired her in New York City, and they said, you know, pretty soon textiles are all going to be khaki. So they ended up training young women, the girls they called them in the newspaper articles, the girls who became draftsmen. Of course, it was draftsmen, because the men had all gone off to war. And then afterwards, being a single parent, she still needed to work and went back and became a draftsman. And the men who were draftsmen at that, and this would have been in the late 40s and the 50s, the men were then sent back to school to become engineers. But the women were not, well, she was probably one of the only women, were not sent out to that further education. So she stayed as a draftsman for 30-some years for General Electric. And at one point, they were downsizing and letting go people. And, of course, she had all the seniority because all of the men had been promoted up to engineers, and she had stayed a draftsman. And she said to me, I feel so bad, these young men, you know, they're supporting families and they're losing their jobs. I said, Mother, what have you been doing all these years? So even with that experience, she still had, well, it wasn't right that the men were being let go.
And maybe she may not have been paid the same as men who had those jobs sometimes.
I just want to commend men. Women have been on such an amazing forward movement for many years now. And I know that the women's feminist movement has certainly impacted men. And at some point, I would like to have that discussion and have men lead a discussion on how these amazing movements forward of women has impacted them or not. And I just want to thank them for letting us be us. That's really important. But I also would like to hear from the men on how it has impacted them in positive ways or perhaps negative ways as well.
Yeah, there's a quote from Margaret Fuller, which is one of our readings in the back of our book, but talking about how this, that equality would be better for everybody. And at the same time, we have certain backlash that is occurring, or has always been occurring at different periods. All right, well, thank you. Thank you, everybody.
I just was wondering if the Wild Outstanding Women WOW is still meeting, and they are on June 2nd, right? So if you want to have get together with your sisters, there you go. Okay, now it's time for the offering. We'll be collecting money for Project Respect.
Members here who had no idea what that song was about. I want a girl just like the girl that married dear old dad. And that's maybe from when? 1900 or
1911.
Do we have any guests or visitors or returning old members who would like to introduce yourselves? Love to hear from you.
Was second on the hit parade that year. It's Alexander's Ragtime Band was first.
Oh, wow.
My name is Candace Lutz, also known as Candy. After many, many decades, I still cannot decide which it should be, nor can my family or friends. It's divided down the middle. I have just retired. I've come back to Madison. I am a reconstituted cheesehead. I was born here. I did my undergrad here. Lived in Illinois for a long, long time, and came back here because this is a wonderful place to be. I also have been a friend of Prairie Circle Unitarian Universalist Congregation, so obviously I had to come out and check out Prairie, even if you're missing the circle part. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's sing our last hymn, which is number 212. And please stand if you're able.
Sister.
closing words actually are not by John Murray. I'm not sure why I thought that they do seem to embody what I think he might have said. Amazingly, there is nothing from John Murray in this hymnal. The Universalists are being overlooked again. And this does talk, it talks about God, which you could interpret as you like, but I think this is the kind of spirit that a number of our folks here on the board would have supported. Go out into the highways and byways. Give the people something of your new vision. You may possess a small light, but uncover it. Let it shine. Use it in order to bring more light and understanding to the hearts and minds of men and women. Give them not hell, but hope and courage. Preach the kindness and everlasting love of God. That's from Alfred S. Cole, who apparently was a Unitarian minister. So do greet your neighbor, regardless of mama, and join us for coffee.
So this is Rob, and this is John right here.
Oh, that's weird. Okay, that's really strange.
Oh, look at that.
Well, that's funny, so I didn't imagine it. Wow, it says John Murray in yours. And this book says Albert Cole, this book says John Murray. There must have been a correction in one of the printings.
Well, I'm trying to figure it out.
Which printing is this?
It's hard
corrected
to tell.
Reprint, but this is